It's been customary in our little community when someone's had a significant retreat experience, provide an opportunity for them to share that experience with the Sangha through one of these meetings. A couple of reasons for that. First of all, a lot of what happens on a retreat for a person is not really correlated. Subconscious and unintegrated. I know from my career as a talk therapist that it really helps for people to verbalize their experience because that process kind of ties it all together, as I say, connects the dots. Plus, it's informative for those people who are participating and also. It might be inspiring, inspire someone to go on a retreat. And I've been on, I think probably more than 50 retreats in my career. It's kind of astonishing to me, but I tried to figure it out the other day and it looks like it's about that much, of varying lengths, most often a week or 2 weeks. So when I have talked about my retreat experience before, it was mostly kind of a review of the day by day experience. And I'm going to touch on that a little bit. But what I want to do with this talk is something that I actually realized that I did several weeks ago during the Open Dharma Questions meeting. I think it was last month. I was prepping myself for the upcoming retreat, which was from the 3rd to the 10th of April, started on the night of Friday the 3rd, and ended on the morning of Saturday the 10th, Friday the 10th. So, what I wanted to do when I gave this talk a few weeks ago, what I wanted to do was kind of explain for myself, connecting the dots, and for those who might be participating, how I understand that the system works. Now, I have not listened to it since. There were no notes for that event to refer to. I have no notes for this one. I do have notes, but not notes that I wrote. Association between what I said before the retreat and what I'm going to say now, I think might be an interesting consideration, interesting contemplation. So I may do that. My retreat, first, I'm going to talk about the retreat format. I've changed it. The last retreat I did in the end of December was challenging. It was pretty painful physically. And the way I had the system set up was part of that. And it was a system set up that I've been doing for decades. But I'm just getting old, I guess. So it just didn't work. And basically, I was sitting 2 hours on the cushion where I'm sitting now and 2 hours on a recliner in the other room and doing that from like 6 in the morning. 5 in the morning, excuse me, until 10 or 10:30 at night, with breaks for breakfast and lunch. And I realized that just didn't work. And I tried to do 2 weeks, but I lasted, I think, 10 or 11 days, partly because of the pain. So this year, last week, I guess, was a 7-day retreat, which means that, as I mentioned earlier, I started on Friday night on the 3rd and ended Friday morning on the 10th. So we actually 6 full days of retreat experience. Now, as I said a few minutes ago, I have been doing this a long, long time. My first retreat was in 1982. So how I set up a retreat, it's not sort of like this is how you have to do it. When I first started doing this, I would sit for 45 minutes and walk for 45 minutes. I haven't done that for years. But it's a very beneficial way. I did it for years, but then I stopped for a variety of reasons and started out paying attention to the breath in a certain kind of way and going further with that. And then get training in the body scan practice. And that shifted things for me. And now I'm kind of trying to integrate the standard mindfulness of breathing practice with the body scanning practice. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. So this last retreat, I sat on the cushion for an hour and on the recliner for 2 hours. And same time schedule, so forth, and when I mean getting up and going to bed. And that seemed to work much better. It was much more beneficial. Took me, basically what I would do is I would come in here at 5 in the morning, sit for an hour, eat breakfast, go for a walk, then sit on the recliner for 2 hours and here for an hour, and so forth and so on until around noon. And then eat breakfast and go for a walk and then start that routine again, alternating sitting on the cushion in the recliner until bedtime. So a couple of days, the first couple of days of the retreat, there were six actual solid practice days. The first couple of days was really kind of getting things stabilized, getting my mind stabilized. And primarily mindfulness of breathing practice. And then on the third day, I started doing body scanning in my own particular way has evolved over the years. And I'm going to talk more about that as going further here. And then the last day it really kind of tapered off, the Thursday, it tapered off. And I've continued to sit. I've been sitting an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening for the most part, except sometimes I sit for 45 minutes, like tonight. Tomorrow night, I'll visit a friend to meditate. So it's, I have a very stable home sitting practice. And I think that's, it took me many years to get to that point, but I really value it. Okay. So now I'm going to bring in a cohort here. I will say a cohort because that indicates a group. I've been using ChatGPT for, all the risks of artificial intelligence. I'm a well-informed consumer of Buddhist concepts, practices, so forth. I've been using AI for a while now, a couple, 3 months, because I think that what it summarizes clarifies things and actually makes it easier for me in terms of doing this. So I have compiled a, I think it's 7 pages, maybe it's longer, printout of question. Basically, what it amounts to is a series of questions that I would ask of the program and then copy the results and edit them and make it into a document. So that's what I'm talking about. This one's called Compare Analyo Anapanasati with Goenka Vedanupassana. Anapanasati is mindfulness of breathing. Vedanupassana is basically the second foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of feelings. So first I'm going to kind of do an overview and talk about how this relates to my actual experience in the retreat. In a sense, I'm having a dialogue with the notes from AI to prompt me to connect the dots in terms of my own experience. So that's my intention here. So first is Analyo's Anapanasati Sutta practice. Talks about the bright breath being the primary anchor. You ride the breath through the whole journey, and it naturally develops heightened body awareness, heightened feeling awareness, a clarity about mind states, and insight into impermanence. right? That's a standard Satipatthana quadrant or four foundations. Goenka's Vedanupassana starts with breath awareness only as a preparation and generally shifts to a systematic body scanning, focusing on the Vedana sensations in the body. So let me talk about how I experienced that. Sensation of breathing is all about intention. In fact, the whole practice is all about chetana, which is intention. And over the decades, I've intended to use various techniques of mindfulness of breathing. Started out with expanding and contracting of the abdomen, and moved to the nose. And then with the Goenka method, it's not with the nose, it's with the body sensations, part of which is the sensations at the nose. What's happened for me in the last several years is really trying to integrate the Anapanasati mindfulness of breathing with the Goenka body scan. So the first couple of days, it was really entirely about the sensation of breathing. Where I noticed the sensation of breathing has evolved, as I mentioned, but lately, and when I say lately, the last couple of years probably, I notice when you breathe in through your nose, there's a sensation. But the air circulates through your nasal passage and then goes down to your lungs. Some of the air swirls into your mouth, particularly when you don't have your tongue pressed to the roof of the mouth. And that touch sensation stimulates the gum and my upper, where my teeth are, and the palate, the hard palate, and the inside of the upper lip. It's palpable. It's noticeable. So what I've done is integrate that with my meditation practice so that I'm aware of whatever's happening in the zone between the nose, the meat of the upper lip, because there's also air moving across the outer area of the upper lip, and I have a mustache, so there's some stimulation there. Plus whatever I mentioned about the roof of the mouth and the inside of the upper lip. So do that very persistently and gently. I used to have an agenda, almost kind of grit my teeth and make it happen, It's much more relaxed now. It's just kind of going along for a ride or tuning into a particular channel. And when the tuner shifts to another frequency, might be a thought, might be sensation elsewhere in the body, just as soon as I can be aware of it, to take note of it and then come back to the breath. Very standard practice. What that does for me, what it did for me on the retreat, is it gave me a chance to stabilize my attention. There are different ways to talk about concentration. One of them is to have a very fixed, exclusive point of reference with no, that's it. It's very determinative that you're going to pay attention to one particular discrete spot, in this case, in the sensation of breathing, to the exclusion of any other sensations. There's another way to regard it, in which is that all the different wholesome functions of the mind, basically what are called the seven awakening factors, mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, persistent right effort, effective management of that energy, kind of enthusiastic interest, which is joy, feeling of tranquility. There's a kind of a soothing quality. All of that is stabilized, which is the concentration awakening factor, and balanced, which is the equanimity awakening factor. So that was a theme throughout the first 3 days, because I practiced that a lot, trying to be clearly mindfully aware of the breath or whatever else is going on in my body, along with that kind of recognition, training to recognize this is mindfulness, this is investigation. For example, when I aim my attention at that target area, and then I rest my attention, kind of soak my attention into that sensation, that is the origination of investigation. That's the training effect, right? And so that becomes more and more persistent and stable, and that calms the whole system down. And that's what Anallo talks about with the mindfulness of breathing. As it says here in the notes for the technical part, it's a gradual sutta-based progression, awareness of the breath, calming of the body formations, experiencing joy and happiness, and observing the transitory nature of your experience. So it's very flexible. Now, with the Goenka practice, which I'll be leading into now, you start at the breath at the nostrils, which sharpens that concentration, like I was talking about the exclusive part, but then broadens it. And that broadening is the full body scanning, which is systematic, observing any kind of gross sensations and any subtle sensations that occur. Now, the gross sensations are pain, stiffness, any kind of sensation that is not, it's hard to see past it. Very demanding of attention, very kind of dense. Okay, so training with the fixed point with the Goenka practice for several days prepares the mind to be really focused and stable and persistent in sweeping attention through the body. And this is what I started to do that third day. The traditional teaching that I first learned started at the top of your head. But I figured out that because the upper lip is so rich in sensation, you know, it's one of the areas of the body that has more nerve endings per cubic than other parts of the body. There's a lot of sensation there already. And also the roof, you know, the palate, the roof of the mouth. So I really start to investigate that. That's what I was doing. And in that investigation, what happens is that the density of the sensation starts to transform into a vibration. Now, that seems magical. But one of the things I did after the retreat was research this vibrational experience, naming the Goenka practice and saying, is there any biological validity to that? And so the AI printout, which I will post within these documents here, describes it as, yeah, this is something going on all the time, everywhere in the body. Because your mind has been trained to be so mindful and investigative in such a persistent way, those are the first three awakening factors. You start to notice these vibes. And it's very much like what happens when your hand goes to sleep. I mean, it's the same phenomena, except when you develop it and investigate it with your meditation practice, it's not quite, it's a different kind of vibe. I'll just say that. And so I would start to systematically with upper lip, lower face, jaw, cheekbones, eye sockets, forehead, temple, top of my head. Now, like I said, I've been doing this for a long time. When I first started doing it, it was very meticulous, required a lot of discipline. It was challenging, both kind of boring and excruciating at the same time. But now I have a lot of proficiency. But I compare it to what it would be like to, for me to learn how to play guitar. It would be really awkward and painful for a while, until I developed proficiency. And if I was willing to practice a lot, the proficiency would come. This is just like that. This is just training. There's nothing mystical or magical or supernatural about it. It's built on the hardware of the human body. Okay. So in that regard, the progression of that vibe experience was moving across my head, down my shoulders, down each arm at the same time, starting at the shoulders, down the upper arm, elbow, lower arm, wrist, so forth, hands, each finger on each hand, and then back up to my head, down through my torso, out through my legs, down to the soles of my feet. And so this would take some time to begin with. I'm obviously not watching a stopwatch. Maybe half an hour. Well, I might spend a whole hour sitting here on this cushion, just systematically doing it. But at one point, and this happened fairly quickly, and probably by the end of the third day, I could drop into a whole body vibe fairly easily. I would start out with that systematic sweeping through, but then it would just kind of become more stable and coordinated and coherent, right? So I had this whole body vibe. Guess what that's called in Buddhism? It's called Bhanga, Bhanga. And so I'm going to include the document about explaining the neuroscience of Bhanga, but also another part that's going to talk about how Bhanga is useful in one's meditation career, so to speak. So the rest of the retreat was basically reattaining Bhanga every time I sat, whether it was on this cushion or on the recliner, over and over and over again, just going into it and just staying there. Now, in the recommendations in this document, one of the things that when you start doing the body scanning from the Goenka perspective, completely forget about the breath. Your primary object, the aiming and sustaining, the investigation, is completely dedicated to body sensations, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. And when you're first learning this, there's a lot of unpleasantness, a lot of reactivity, right? But when that happens in the Goenka tradition, you just go back to the breath and restabilize and then re-engage the body scanning. I kind of had to do that. What I've done is I'm really routinely alternating attention back and forth between breath awareness and the upper lip. Usually at that point, it's the upper lip, the palate, and the area around the nose. All of that's one kind of core area of attention. That's my primary focus. And then back to the body scanning and just hanging out there. And what I noticed in that context, in terms of the Hanalio presentation of mindfulness of breathing, the experience of breathing fades. You stop breathing. Breathing becomes very, very subtle and kind of disappears in awareness. Now, this can be alarming at first, but it's not because I'm trying to make the breath stop. It's that what I'm doing is being so diligent in investigating the sensation of breathing and dropping into a whole body awareness with it, which is not the same as the Veda Nupassana. Eventually the breath just kind of goes away. With the Goenka practice, I kind of just ignore the breath until it's useful. Then I pay attention to it again. But the breath also, particularly on the out breath, just starts to fade and fade and gets prolonged and prolonged and prolonged. And I just ride with that. And that's what I was doing quite a lot on the retreat. In both practice traditions, it's important to be patient, to identify any felt sense of urgency and let it go. Open, relax, accept. Whether, as far as I'm concerned, whether I'm doing the Anapanasati or the Veda Nupassana, the same principle applies. Very, very important to recognize that. And there's a Zen phrase, a saying, the gateless gate. Awakening has a gateless gate. So if you create a gate in your mind, you'll never go through it. But there is a gate. I realize it sounds kind of mysterious, but there's a very subtle kind of refined attention that develops that's really pretty remarkable. This Bhanga experience, the whole body vibe, I mentioned that. In that experience, my mind loses any interest in discerning where the body is. In other words, there's just this in the mind, my eyes closed, there's just this vibratory field. And there's no interest in saying, okay, that part of it's my leg, that part of it's my hand. There's just this diffuse, immaterial body of vibrations. And actually tonight, that's the other thing about this. My years of these practices, when I was sitting tonight, experiencing Bhanga, but not to the extent of dissolution, where there's complete loss of interest in defining a body, or even discerning that there's any difference between that vibratory field and any ambient sound. It just becomes holistic, unified. And I just hang out there, for long periods of time. Like I said, I'm not using a timer. I mean, I use a timer, but I don't keep track of time. I sit till the bell rings. So in terms of there used seem to be a controversy about Veda Nupassana. It's not real Vipassana. It's not real practice as described in the Satipatthana Sutta. Of course, Goenka and his crew say, yes, it is. Well, it turns out that Anallo has great respect for Goenka. In fact, I just read an article that he wrote that's dedicated to S.N. Goenka. He wrote this article after Goenka died a few years ago. And there's several articles that Anango has written that basically says what Goenka is teaching is just a different way of describing what was already there in early Buddhism. There's nothing wrong about it. There's nothing radical about it. It's completely legitimate. So I've talked with this about this with a bunch of people, and my sense is that every generation has a task in terms of spiritual development, in terms of just cultural development. Whatever we're presented, in this case, the classical teachings of Buddhism here in the West, in my 20s and 30s, it was really starting to show up. been around for a while. It started in the 50s and early 60s, and I became aware of it in the early 70s. That we have to read and come to some understanding of the concepts, whether we're talking about Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, whatever, Taoism, and put it into a context that's relevant to our particular culture, our particular era. In fact, I just downloaded a book today, the Dalai Lama, saying that I didn't have a chance to read it, basically saying Buddhism going forward has to really integrate with scientific research. It's absolutely required. It's not this kind of mystical religious thing. This is very pragmatic. This is very real. And that's what we're doing. That's what I'm doing, even as I'm speaking right now, is trying to sort this out in the context of what life is like these days on the world, on the planet, in this case, particularly in this culture. I think that that's very promising that there's that support from Anália, who I have a great deal of respect for. I've gone through a couple of his trainings and read almost all of his books, particularly ones about Satipatthana and Anapanasati. That integration seems to be where that's my trajectory. That's my gateless gate, is to really see how this, what goes on, what's going on next. That's for me, that's one of the most important aspects of my meditation practice these days. Every time I sit down, there's this curiosity, what's going to happen this time? And this is particularly the case on a retreat, because the mind gets so into it. There's a vital importance to that kind of curiosity. That's what takes the practice further. Now, I can kind of impose a trajectory on this and say, I'm going to practice this and then I'm going to experience awakening. As soon as I do that, it's not going to work. The way it works is you really understand the concepts. You really diligently apply the training and wait and see what happens. It's sort of like getting a lot of really good musical training and then being really, really good at jamming, right? Improvising. Because that's what we're doing. We're making it up as we go along. So I place a very high value on my retreat experience. Looking forward to doing this again, hopefully in December. I said I'm going to post these notes. Please understand that I'm reading this as if I was reading a commentary or a book about the same topic by some author, right? I may agree, I may disagree. I may say, oh, this is the way it works for me. You have to find out the way it works for you. The last words out of the Buddha's mouth when he was dying was, you have to work out your own salvation with diligence. Don't rely on any other teachers. You can rely on a teacher to support you, but you got to do the work yourself. And to me, that's what's really remarkable about Buddhism, because faith from a Buddhist perspective means self-efficacy. It means having confidence in certain capabilities, certain techniques, if you will. You have technical competence in the zone, as some really highly developed athletes say. And once you're in there, what's going to happen? It's just what's going to happen. And you go along for it, for it. And I think that's very, very important for us to consider. So I'm sure I've left some things out, and maybe some more of it will come up. People ask me some interesting questions. And Val, you had your hand up a minute ago.
You answered my questions, but meanwhile, I came up with another one in the Analaya or in the Anapanasati practice. When you are really focused on the breathing, do you switch your attention to notice that now you have, you said something like four qualities? Do you switch focus and you say, now I'm having that quality, now I'm having that quality?
Yes.
Or is it in the background?
Well,
You know what I'm saying?
and I could get a bit nitpicky about that. One perspective of Buddhism is that each moment, and when I say moment, fraction of a second, has its own characteristics. And then it falls apart, and another moment comes up that has some trace of the preceding moment, but has its own unique characteristics, right? So a major goal of this practice is to track that. That's anicca, impermanence, which is something Goenka emphasizes a lot. From that nitpicky point of view, at one moment there's kind of a pure breath awareness, and the next moment there is a conceptual investigation. Is this mindfulness? Oh, yes, this is mindfulness. And then back to the breath, right? But it blends together. One of the things that's interesting about being on a retreat and having a maturing practice is that I'm capable of really being clear of that shift, about that shift, rather, that I can be really aware that there's one moment, there's breath awareness, and then the next moment it's not really breath awareness, it's thinking awareness, right? Or conceptual awareness, right? So there's two different understandings of impermanence. One of them I described in terms of the arising and passing away of the mind's interpretation of reality at each moment. The other one is, which is pretty much it's very corollary to it, similar to it, is how attentive you are. Are you being mindful about it or not? Are you really investigating it or kind of skipping it over? You know, are you balanced or is the mind too urgent? Oh, that's another thing I want to mention. It's in the notes. The vagus nerve. One of the things that's been the vagus nerve is a very large complex of nerves distributed from the base of the spine, I mean, the base of the brain rather, down through the body, and connecting to a lot of the organs in the torso, particularly the abdomen, the gut. And another part of that vagus nerve goes from those organs back up to the brain. So there's a feedback system going on. There are basically two of them. One of them is neurological, the vagus process, vagal process. The other one is hormonal, the adrenal glands and other kinds of hormones that are being extracted into the bloodstream from the body, right? All of that's mixing together. So, the more that vagal process is balanced, one part of the process is sedating. Another part of it, of the vagal process, is activating. When there's too much sedation, you've got sloth and torpor, or the hindrances. When there's too much activation, you've got restlessness and worry, right? Well, actually, restlessness is a physical experience. Worry is the mental experience, right? So those interactions are what we're trying to investigate. So you can be mindful in as immediately as possible, as persistent as possible. What's going on in the mind right now? That's actually the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind. Are you alert or is your mind dull? Is your mind stable or distracted? Is it driven by desire or aversion or free from that?
Is it the same thing that you just described with the sympathetic and
Sympathetic and
parasympathetic? It's the same
parasympathetic.
thing.
Sympathetic is the activating, parasympathetic is the sedating. And there it's pretty much a lot of it's mitigated by what's going on in that vagal nerve process. Very interesting stuff. And once again, that's the integration of 21st century neuroscientific research with, 2000 plus year old wisdom. Right. So, other questions or comments? Anybody?
Peter, it's Karen.
Okay,
When
Karen, and then we'll get to.
Thank you. When you talked about being in that state of just vibrations, not so there was no thoughts or anything going on. I mean, you had, because you said you were just it feeling just vibrations. You didn't really say that's my foot or
Right.
there was
Thoughts would
no.
be, the thoughts would be, that's my foot.
Yes.
There wasn't that. There was just awareness without narrative. But it could slide into narrative. The more I could get into the Bhanga, just inhabit that zone, the less interesting any kind of descriptive thought was. It was just directly knowing of that field. Now, I want to say that I what I'm talking about with my practice is integrative. I'm not trying to say that the Goenka method is better or worse, or the Anallo method is better or worse. It's my job to put it together to the best use of liberation. So I kind of jumped off on that, Karen. Is that
No, I understand. I was just it was just curiosity, what was going on, if anything, in the mind. I mean, because it was mostly just vibrations. But I do have one other question. So if we're just practicing mindfulness of the body, Vipassana, not Goenka. But mindfulness of the body, is it the same practice as Goenka that we just forget about the
No,
breath?
no. Mindfulness of the body in the Satipatthana Sutta basically means postural awareness and being aware of. There are various contemplations that I think are archaic and not useful, that you visualize or you imagine the spleen and the heart and the lungs, and you imagine what the body's like when it's after you're dead and it's decaying, right? That does not seem to be useful to me in this day and age. I kind of disregard that. What the that's the first foundation of mindfulness, Kaya Nupassana, mindfulness of the body. I mentioned Veda Nupassana as the part of the Goenka tradition. That's mindfulness of feelings. That's the second foundation. But what's interesting is when he's talking about feelings, he's not talking about emotions. He's not talking about impulsive reactivity, wanting or not wanting. What he's talking about is this vibratory field. Just that. And we, so it is, it's not really, feelings will come with it, but it's not really a feeling. So I don't, I, it's, that's, I think it, I'm not quite clear. I guess they had to pick a spot to land with this practice to understand it or explain it conceptually. So they landed on feelings. But it's also the mind and it's also the body. So, but that's what I'm saying. When you really think about this a lot, you practice trying to put it into play. My understanding of how the system operates is much different now than it was years ago. And I'm very grateful for that. Is that helpful, Karen? Yes.
It is for the beginner's mind.
Yes.
It is. Now, I appreciate it. Thanks, Peter.
You're welcome. Satish.
So you use the word investigate in your explanation. Is that, are you doing an investigation by mind, using mind?
Well, of course.
Huh?
Of course. But what I think what you're saying is my thinking about it.
Right.
Am I creating a story about it?
Not creating, anyway, it's
There's a difference between knowing and thinking in this context. Thinking involves some kind of storyline, narrative, descriptive. Knowing is just direct experiential awareness.
notice.
Noticing, knowing, whatever.
But you use the word investigate.
Investigate it is in that second zone. But here's the deal. It's in the zone of knowing rather than thinking. But like I was saying before about mindfulness of breathing, to Val was is that I can be aware that there's a direct knowing, and then up on this other channel, there's a little storyline. Right? You probably heard me say this before. As the practice matures, the voice that's on your shoulder, screaming in your ear, is now in the other room with the door closed. You can decide whether you want to pay attention to it or not. That's called dispassion, right? I know that it's there, doesn't have much appeal. The same thing is true with thinking. Just like I said, when I'm in that field, that bhanga, part of me could, kind of figure out, okay, that's my leg. But it's not interesting. It's not engaging. There's no felt need to make that kind of determination. There's just resting attention in that openness, that inclusivity.
Yeah, to me, the word attention would be more appropriate, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. But
Okay.
investigating kind of, to me, implies like a narrative and a mind involved.
No, this is without narrative. But when, here's the deal is that the trick is to be able to learn how to have that same kind of detached knowing about the thinking. That's what I'm trying to say about it. It's in the other room. I might decide that there's some value in opening the door and listening or tuning into that channel, right? There might be some liberation benefit from that. But right now, it's good where I am. So this part where I am is not really thinking, it's knowing, or is attention. Over here is narrative,
If
which
you
in the
choose to deal with it.
right, there's the ability to make that discernment. And in the Goenka training, that's called sankhara. There's a different understanding of sankhara in the tradition that Anallo talks about.
Sorry,
So,
I have a question about
yes,
this.
sir.
Can I ask? So there are two methods of mindfulness, right? Goenka and the other one is this mindful of breathing, correct? What is the purpose of mindfulness?
Mindfulness is considered to be the guardian at the gate or the chief minister. This goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha. The guardian at the gate basically means your sense of subjectivity is like a walled city. And mindfulness is the guardian at the gate who pays attention to everything that goes in the gate or out the gate, right? Okay. That mindfulness informs the decision, and then there's an action on it to either let that happen, come in, or disregard it. Okay. So the other is the chief minister. The other simile, metaphor rather, is that a chief minister's job is to stay in contact with, stay in good communication with Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Economy, the Secretary of Health, et cetera, et cetera. All these different subcategories of the government, and have a clear understanding of what's going on, you know, how well they're doing their job, reporting that to the monarch, right? That's the chief minister's job. So that's another way to understand mindfulness. It's there's a mindfulness. The contemporary determination of that is called metacognition. And if you Google, if you go to Wikipedia and Google or inquire about metacognition, what you read there is very much in line with what mindfulness is. Self-awareness, self-regulation, the ability to monitor your actions, et cetera, et cetera. That's the equivalent, contemporary equivalent to mindfulness. What's curious is that Wikipedia has not mentioned that yet. It's talked about it being related to the Stoics, but not about to mindfulness.
You can change it. You can edit it.
I thought about doing that as to want to bother.
Good. So this is what I think mindfulness is. Mindfulness is being in the present. Otherwise, I'm having a narrative. I'm in the past or the future. Mindfulness is to be in the present. As simple as that.
So here's another way I describe how the system works. There's energy coming into the light bulb here in the room. The light bulb, you know, the filament gets heated up and it radiates light, but it's a very wasteful application of the energy. There's a lot of loss, heat, and so forth and so on. Okay, if you took that same amount of light and you ran it through a device called a laser, it would come out the business end of the laser with minimal loss of energy, maximum coherence and potency, right? All right, that's concentration from a Buddhist perspective. That beam, that laser beam is concentration. Mindfulness is a mirror that's placed in that beam that reflects the beam back on the laser. Investigation is the programming that's assessing the functioning of that laser and making course correction when necessary. So mindfulness is that ability for self-reflection. Investigation is the programming that's operating where that mirror is reflecting the laser to. And that programming is sankhara. There's unwholesome sankhara and there's wholesome sankhara.
Self-reflection could be about your rumination or being in the past.
Yeah.
You're doing that.
Yeah. But this is a different kind. It's a specific kind. Look it up. Look up metacognition on Wikipedia and read what it says. It's very, very congruent with Buddhist understanding of mindfulness. I'm really enjoying these questions. Somebody have, yes, April.
Well, and also that mindfulness is designed to work with the other parts of the Eightfold Path, right? So it's always like working with right effort, and then all of it is under right view. And so mindfulness is never just kind of like on it, you know, by itself. And then also it's, you know, the underlying factor in the seven factors of awakening. So just I always like to bring in the other parts of the path as well. And then I had a question Bhanga, is that the word?
Yes, Bhanga.
So how does that connect for you with the description and the seven factors of awakening with like rapture? Like when they describe rapture sometimes as being like a whole body vibratory experience.
From the Goenka perspective, they don't talk about rapture. Bhanga might be considered to be rapture, but they don't describe it that way at all. They don't talk about jhana. They talk about just being aware of body sensations, feeling tones. And the whole goal of it is to be aware of the impermanence, the unreliability of subjective experience. It's changing all the time. And the impersonality of it, the absence of an enduring autonomous self. So that's what that's the application of that. I don't, does that help?
I mean, I actually also did use AI before and did a lot of research on comparing these as well, Goenka, to Thai forest traditions interpretation of the mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of body, and then also Bhikkhu and Alio. And one thing that came up in my research too was that Goenka intentionally. He was kind of like a precursor to the Jack Kornfield, Tara Brach, you know, accessible mindfulness to reach as many people as possible, and that chose not to use words like jhana or, you know, refer to sort of states that people would chase, that he was really like trying to break it down in a way that could be experiential and not confusing to people. So thought that was
Yes.
interesting.
And that's part of the cultural adaptation that I'm talking about, the
Exactly.
intergenerational trying to make the best fit. But the concern is, first of all, if the whole ethical aspiration is dropped, that's a worry. And secondly, it's important. This is why it's so important to think for a person who teaches this to have some serious meditation practice is because I speak from how well I have been able to authentically integrate what I've read with my sitting practice, you know, the training, and my lived experience. So I think otherwise it can talk the talk, but you can't walk the walk. Kind of thing. It's all
Definitely.
conceptual. It's not practical. I mean, really, what karma means what you do.
Yeah.
What you do. And so that's the most important part. Julian,
I
you
saw.
have your hand up. Go ahead, April. What?
I was just going to say the same thing that I saw Julian's hand up before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just so you mentioned that well, this vibratory field, if it's kind of present, and I guess what I have experienced is because there is a stress in Goenka for working with Anapanasati for one third of the retreat's length, so the mind gets so concentrated and calm that it's able to notice this kind of natural state of the body. And for example, people which also practice Tai Chi or yoga, when they are doing this, maybe they stay in the posture or they do the movements with such concentration, they can also notice this vibratory field.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess by calming the minds, it's possible to notice that.
Now, it's not
And
just calming the
also,
mind. That's important, Julian. That's important. But if the mind is calm, without mental alertness, dullness occurs. So there has to
Yeah,
be
that's.
a quality of inquiry. That's what I mean about how important curiosity is.
Yeah.
That what's going on in that moment with that breath, or that asana, that yoga posture, or that Tai Chi movement. There has to be an active investigative involvement. What's going on right now?
Yeah. And also, for example, just by this noticing the sensations, either just subtle or gross sensations or the whole body vibratory field, one can practice, or one can notice the ever-changing feature of it. And maybe one can also notice how attached is one to one certain specific sensation, and or how one clings to or try to refuse such specific sensations. So I
That's an important part of the Goenka training, isn't it? That you work with what comes up, not with what you expect there to be. So if the vibration is unpleasant, that's your practice. That's where your growth potential occurs, not just when it's a neutral or a pleasant vibe, but when the vibe is urgent and kind of cranky, right? You know that, right, Julian?
Yeah. So I guess that different like teachers or different lineages focus on the specific parts. I usually do the analogy, for example, I'm teaching maths, and if I'm teaching, for example, percentage, I can focus on the decimal representation of percentage or the fractional representations of percentage, but at the end is just different ways of
Yes.
practicing tool that leads to into.
Yes, it's just commentary on all of it's commentary for Goenka and Anato. They're both commenting on the Satipatthana Sutta. The Anapanasati Sutta is sort of like prepping for really making the most out of the Satipatthana. In fact, at the end of the Anapanasati Sutta, it says the perfection of Anapanasati inevitably reveals the fullness of Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness.
Thank you.
John, you had something, and then Val, and then we'll be done for the night.
Basically, it's just that everybody thinks in words, and that we've said it over and over tonight, and I think that's a valuable awareness to have, because you have thinking and breathing and well, I was adding thinking, you're talking. I got to get new glasses, I can tell you that. But anyway, what I'm driving at is that you have your seven senses and you apply it with words, and that's all you got, and that's all we've all got.
Yep.
And that's our gift, is our balance, is to go back to breath
Yep.
and learn to get out of that brain, because you'll hang yourself. You'll think, that's all there is, and it's not.
Nope.
So, go back to breath.
Yes. Val?
A quick question. She mentioned that the Forest Thai Foundation, Forest Thai tradition, where does that go within this? Do you know?
Well, the forest tradition is a different way of approaching Satipatthana. And that's what it means, is that in Thailand, for the most part, but somewhat some extent in Burma, there are scholastic renunciates in the populated areas, and then there are the people who are out in the woods, so to speak, the mountains, meditating. The scholars don't really meditate that much, but the forest monks do. So that's just the distinction made between scholastic and experiential, I would say. Now, that's not to say that the experiential are not good students. They are. In fact, that's an important part of the revival of Buddhism, because most Buddhism for centuries was scholastic. But then in the late 19th and early 20th century and on up to present, there's been more and more interest in the discipline of retreats. But for most Buddhists in the Orient, it's really sort of like going to church. You have certain chants and certain things that you repeat, and you support the monks and so forth. But that's another thing that's really interesting about Buddhism here, is that we're not a monastic community and probably never will be. So what are we going to do with that? How can we make that work? All right, so we're at the end of our sitting time tonight. We've actually had a pretty long meeting, but I really enjoyed our conversation. So let's sit together briefly in silence, which is what we do. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well.